So just to begin, can you state your name and title?
Eva Thibodeau-Gralchick, and I am the CEO of Temenos Community Development Corporation. Temenos exists to provide housing and supportive services for the most vulnerable amongst us, particularly those who have been long time living in homelessness and experiencing multiple disabling conditions, such as serious mental illness, substance use, so on and so forth.
And housing is essentially the core principle of this.
Yes, we were founded in 2006 by pastors Rudy and Juanita Rasmus from St. John's United Methodist Church. And the church had long been opening their arms and welcoming in their unhoused neighbors who lived around the church. That grew into feeding, it grew into an overnight shelter, it grew into a day center. And then what they realized over time was that a lot of people were being offered housing and were moving off of the streets, but they were people who were really able to fend for themselves. And the folks who were staying year after year, day after day, season after season, were the people who were the most seriously mentally ill, the least able to connect, the most disorganized. And so they specifically started Temenos, in order to address the needs of those people.
How has your work evolved over time as you've gotten more experience and understanding with this population?
So what's interesting, I think you can see our learning in our buildings. Our first building, when you walk in, there's a lobby and then, corridors, a very, rather traditional multifamily housing. In our second building, we realized that we needed more offices for case managers, caseworkers, things like that, and also that we needed more common space. In the building that we're building right now, we have lots of office space for supportive services. We have probably five times as much common space. And that common space can be segmented in different ways. It can also be opened up to each other. When you look at, again, the design of our buildings, the need for there to be a place to come together and break bread and eat, and share in food and meal times, but also, in yoga and art classes, in meditation, in, silence, a place for reading, a place to be part of a community where you can still be yourself and find yourself. And so I would say that a lot of our learnings, we've stayed deeply, deeply rooted in housing first and not making sobriety or medication adherence, a requirement of housing. But what we have learned is the importance of community and the importance of bringing people together in order to really heal them, and heal themselves through community and connection.
So one criticism about the housing first model has been that people are not required to be sober or to have all their issues addressed before getting housing. Housing first flips that on its head.
So let me ask you a question. Do you have neighbors? Do any of them utilize substances such as alcohol or smoking?
I'm sure they do.
And is that their business or is it your business? Their business. And so why should we hold people who are experiencing the ongoing trauma and crisis of living in homelessness to standards that are higher than what we hold ourselves and our other housed neighbors to? That's always my basic answer. But even beyond that, I would argue that, and time and efforts have shown this, that housing itself is a powerful healing intervention. And to ask someone who is in a state of crisis, trauma, and feeling unsafe to do really oftentimes very deep emotional and trauma healing, unhoused, not knowing if they're going to eat, not knowing where their next meal is going to come from, not feeling any sense of physical safety to, oh, get sober and let's do some mental health counseling. And why don't you just self-actualize while you're at it? it's not realistic.
It essentially, it sounds like, goes off the principle of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You have to take care of your basic needs before you can have that higher level of self-actualization.
Absolutely. And what we do find is that once people are housed, once they have time to spend in communal settings, we do a breakfast club so that people can come down and, get a cup of coffee, have some breakfast. We serve lunch. We have activities or movie times throughout the day. We're staffed 24/7, so there's always someone to talk to. And we find that just by increasing nutrition, by offering opportunities for, you know, safe and sober socialization and times to be in community, it actually decreases a lot of that substance use, and it helps heal serious mental illness.
So from what I understand, Houston's Housing First model is more successful than it has been in other cities. Why do you think that is?
There are a number of reasons. Really, when we undertook changing our system work, so when we went really from deserving, or when we went from being housing ready to housing first as a system, we started really, really, really early. And we had incredibly motivated political leadership at both our city and county levels. We also had new leadership within our public housing authorities. For the first time ever in the greater Houston area, our housing authority leadership saw that they had a place in ending homelessness. And so they brought vouchers to the table, which allowed us to leverage other resources and use them more effectively so that we could expand housing in this housing first model. We also, as a community, and this is really critical, most communities, providers, service providers have really held onto the decision-making power of where resources are allocated. And as a person who runs a nonprofit, you know, I get that. You want that power. I don't want to give up my piece of the pie because I have to fight for my organization. At the same time, that makes me not a good system level decision maker. I can't dispassionately look at where resources should be allocated. And so in Houston, with a lot of Department of Housing and Urban Affairs, they gave us tons of technical assistance and really, really, really amazing people from all over the country spent years in Houston helping us to, you know, change the way that we did business. And one of those things is that we put together a governance board called the COC Steering Committee, Continuum of Care Steering Committee. And that steering committee does have provider representatives on it who represent providers. However, it is mostly made up of the folks who have the resources, private philanthropists, the Veterans Administration, our housing authority directors, our housing economic community development department directors. Those are the folks who are at the table really making the decisions about the policies and how we should work as a system.
So it's the collaboration is what you're saying that's made this work. In other cities, agencies or nonprofits are kind of working against each other.
They are. And in a lot of areas, too, you know, you'll have just different jurisdictions within, you know, a homeless response region, and those jurisdictions won't even work together. For us, our city, our county, and three other entitlement jurisdictions all came together and came up with, we have common policies, we have common rules, and we make funding decisions as a group so that we're getting really the biggest effect and the most efficiency for the dollars that are available across our region. And that's huge. There's so much turf war in places that's a hard thing to get to. We have partners across the system who do housing, but also, you know, we work with fair market apartments as well that are not owned by nonprofits. And so, you know, we have thousands of people with housing subsidies. And even within Temenos, we go out into the community to other people's apartments where we have helped place residents, and we do case management supportive services for them there. So it's a really wide network, and there are multiple ways of doing it. One of the things that makes Temenos incredibly unique is that we have almost zero barriers to entry. If you qualify for the Housing Authority voucher, we will not put anything additional on you. So we don't do credit checks. We don't care about your eviction history. We are extremely, extremely open regarding backgrounds. We really, truly do believe that everybody deserves to have a place to live. And as our pastors like to say, we're going to love you no matter what, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Can you describe what housing looks like in this system? You get a voucher, and then what kind of apartment comes next?
At Temenos, the units that we own and operate are all micro efficiencies, but they do have, you know, a kitchen, their own bathroom, you know, furniture. The space is really, you know, in the common space is where you have your most living area. And in those cases, we work directly with the housing authority. And so we have vouchers on each of the rooms. And so we help people, you know, do their applications. When we have folks who are going to be living out in the community, we go and we do landlord engagement. We talk with them. We explain that, you know, this is how the rent will be paid, whether it's directly by Temenos with HUD funds or whether it's through a voucher. We really try to take that burden off of the client who's trying to get housed. You know, we're there every step of the way to help make sure they have all their documents for move-in, to do all of the paperwork. It can be incredibly overwhelming when you're looking at like 80 pages for an application for a housing voucher. And then intimidating, of course, to talk to landlords and you don't know, you know, what to ask all the time or how you're going to be received and perceived. So we go with folks to do that. And then we're there with them on the day of move-in to help them walk through and say, yep, no, okay, everything looks like it's in good condition. And then to really talk about, hey, let's look at like how your appliances work. You know, let's make sure that you understand how to do this. Let's check out the laundry room, you know, how do you use the laundry, things like that.
What is the average length of stay that people are in the system?
Our average is typically, I would say, around 7 years. A lot of people who come to us, because you have to remember that when people have lived unhoused for long amounts of time, studies have shown that they age at a rate of about 15 years older than their housed counterparts. Every once in a while, we have people who live into what, you know, housed people would consider old age. But, you know, it's more typical that people are seeing advanced age conditions in their 50s and 60s. And so for many people, we are their last home. And while it is hard to lose people who we've welcomed and embraced, what I always tell my staff and our volunteers and the rest of the community is that at least they died with the dignity of a roof over their head and a community where people knew their name. They weren't John Doe under the bridge found by the police. And so that's a big way that people leave. Other people, you know, they really, after several years of receiving services and having, I would say, the resolution of trauma of having been unhoused and being able to wake up in their own space and control their own environment, they do decide to take that voucher and move elsewhere, just out into the community where there aren't supportive services. That's typically how people move on. Now, when we're working with younger people, like the, you know, aging out of foster care and you know, different criminal justice and juvenile detention systems, that group we're typically looking at, you know, helping them to move on and to gain skills once they've, you know, recovered from their trauma. But we have, you know, we have people who've lived with us for 7, 8, 9 years. We still have some of the first residents who moved into our buildings in 2009 living with us. Our very first resident has actually moved out and has come back to be a staff member. So she's been with us for the long haul. And we have multiple people who are current or former residents who are also now on our staff.
Can you just talk briefly about how the unhoused population in Houston has changed since the Housing First model became the norm?
So I actually just today was reading an article in the Houston Chronicle, and it cited that since 2011, when we embraced Housing First and shifted our entire system from Housing Ready to Housing First, we've reduced homelessness by 63%. And you have to remember that, you know, homelessness is not a one and done. It's always a dynamic picture. All of the upstream systems that are extremely broken, racist, inadequate, you know, so on and so forth, are still driving people into homelessness. And so, you know, there's just been this constant churn to keep people housed and to keep on housing. Year over year, for the most part, we have continued to reduce those numbers. The last several years, we had a slight bump up during COVID, but it was fairly negligible. We've stayed around, when you look at like a snapshot picture of one night in the city of Houston, you know, how many people are sleeping unsheltered. We've stayed around 1,500 on any given night in Houston of people living unsheltered. And that is down from 8,000.
Wow, those are some remarkable numbers. I imagine that the experience of being in the city has also changed for other residents. Nationwide, I think that's something that a lot of people are struggling with. Just how the cityscape has changed so much in the last few years with the dramatic increase in tent encampments and people living on the street. But in Houston, the opposite has happened. Can you speak to that?
Well, you know, so what's fascinating about Houston is that when I moved here in 97, I lived in an area that has now been gentrified or revitalized into two distinct, very urban, very higher income areas. At the time, though, when I moved here, it was pretty much abandoned houses. There wasn't any commerce. All of the homeless service providers were kind of in this area. Lots of, you know, prostitution, drug activity, and people didn't live downtown. They didn't live near downtown. You know, the suburbs were the place to be. After 5 o'clock, Monday through Friday, and on the weekends, there was nobody downtown except for people who were experiencing street homelessness. So a lot of tax dollars were reinvested into these areas in order to make them more vibrant, to make them livable, to, you know, bring in dollars and business and all of these things. It's been wonderful. But now, you know, by all of this amazing stuff happening, and by we have a bayou system that a lot of people used to, when we would do street outreach, we'd be out under the bridges in the bayous. Well, those have really, I mean, our city has done a beautiful job, but they've been made into beautiful parkways and walkways and biking trails. And so all of these activities have served to push people experiencing unsheltered homelessness out of hidden spots where people didn't go, really into the limelight. And so while numbers are down, optically, people see more street homelessness than what they used to.
So what is not working in the model that you would like to change? It sounds like there's a lot of success, but is there anything that you would want to change in what you guys are doing for this next chapter?
You know, part of Housing First also is leveling the playing field for everyone. So for us as a housing provider, when we have an available unit, we go to a centralized wait list, and people are prioritized on that wait list according to their length of time homeless and how severe their vulnerabilities are. And so we just take the next person on that wait list, which is fantastic and how it should be. Everyone has an equal chance of getting housing anywhere. In theory, it works beautifully. In reality, we're dealing with huge bureaucracies and systems. And, you know, the lack of landlords wanting to oftentimes take our clients, and their ability to discriminate against their form of rental payment. So they don't have to accept a housing choice voucher. They don't have to accept a rental subsidy from an organization. And so oftentimes our folks are relegated to not the healthiest places, you know, to live and grow in Houston. I would say, you know, the mechanics of the system can be daunting and exhausting to deal with on a daily basis, but I don't know what we can do about that. If I had my druthers, we would all have housing as a basic human right. And that just wouldn't even be an issue. That would really be nice. You know, right now we're creating awesome systems to manage finite resources. We're really, if things were just, everyone would be housed and have an option for housing, and we'd be working on other issues.
Are there models out there in other countries where housing is more successful for unsheltered people that you could point to?
You know, I've done some work with Canadian and British partners, and they struggle with different things than we do. They have more what they call social housing, which is what we would call public housing. And, you know, after the 80s, we stopped investing in, you know, housing authority, publicly owned housing. And that's been a huge loss as far as, you know, affordable housing and keeping people housed and driving, you know, the upswing in unsheltered homelessness and homelessness amongst families. But, you know, when I talk to my counterparts in other parts of the world, their struggles may look different, but no one has really tackled how to really eliminate this. Germany has, I have two cousins who live in Germany, both who have serious mental illness, and their models of community housing for people with serious mental illness with all wraparound services provided is really extraordinary. The burden that a family with a loved one experience schizophrenia, for example, the burden and the stress on a family in the United States, you know, trying to deal with that, you see so much burnout. You see people, you know, eventually just rejecting their loved one because they just can't do it for whatever reason. Many times we'll have, especially men who show up in the homeless response system for the first time in their 30s or 40s. And you come to find out once you kind of piece the story together that they had been living with a grandma or a mother. And once that person passed, then no one else in the family was willing to take them in. And that's when they became homeless. The social housing and the wraparound safety nets and services that I've seen in Germany are really, really extraordinary. I wish we had more options like that.
When you did build the developments, and you have three, was there any community resistance to building housing where you did, and how did you get community buy-in?
So not in my backyard, NIMBY. Love that. It is rampant. So we were very fortunate in our three developments. We owned the land already. And so we had what was called site control. We did have to get, you know, letters of support in order to get the public funding that we got for these and had to do an open community meeting, which we did. The fact that we're situated near the church that founded us gave us, and how respected they are in the community, gave us a really, really strong partner to support the work. So we were uniquely positioned in that way. Also, where our properties are located, at the time that we started developing there, there was almost no other residential housing around. It was mostly businesses or vacant lots and a really large hospital near us. And so the circumstances were definitely different. But, you know, I always tell people, I'm like, if you can get your proof point by, you know, working with a nonprofit or, you know, a church that already has access to land, which can reduce some hurdles to get your first building built, and then use that as a proof point for community members in new development areas to come and say, hey, come see what we're about. This is what we do. This is who we are. Look at this beautiful building. Look at, you know, our residents, our staff. You know, this is our safety record. You know, things like that. It can help build the case to reduce resistance in future developments.
Is there anything you're hopeful for with addressing homelessness in this country on a more national scale?
With COVID dollars, with the ARPA dollars that came in from the feds, you know, as a community, we really were able to use a lot of those dollars to do our housing of folks in encampments to kind of put it on steroids and do some incredible work. HUD and Congress have stepped up and have did a one-time special allocation specifically to address people with the most long-term homelessness and unsheltered homelessness. And they put out a request for proposals basically for funding nationwide outside of their regular competition time to infuse additional dollars into systems to address that. I think, and I'm hopeful that the problems of homelessness, of unstable housing, and of housing cost burdens on families and the extreme need for affordable housing is reaching a place nationally where it's getting a lot more attention And I'm hoping that we will continue to invest heavily in that sector.
Is there anything else you want to add that we did not address today?
For whatever it's worth, I do want to point out, and other communities do have this, but we have a very, very long running relationship with our law enforcement, starting with the Houston Police Department. And then they did a lot of training for the Harris County Sheriff's Office. And both of them have what are called HOT officers, and it stands for Homeless Outreach Teams. And they have specially trained officers who are paired with someone from our mental health authority. And they do street outreach every single day. And, you know, they go places and have access to things that a lot of our other outreach teams don't. And they've been a really huge part of helping people get housed and get connected to housing and to services. And so that, and then they also have done extensive training and partner again with mental health authorities to have mobile crisis outreach teams and to have crisis intervention response teams who, you know, you can call and say, you know, I need a CERT trained officer because we have a mental health crisis going on, and they'll come out with a social worker and, you know, respond. And so being able to work with law enforcement with some of the ways that they're uniquely positioned in their authority and power, but where they're also, you know, joining with the forces of ending homelessness has been really powerful.
I'm glad you brought that up, because something that came up in an interview I had previously with a woman living on the streets in Salt Lake City was how the police are often coming and doing sweeps and removing everyone's tents. There's a dichotomy of, you know, there's a tension, I guess, is a better word. Obviously, you know, someone's whole life is in that tent and then they lose everything. And so it's good to hear that there are other models out there of how the police could work with this population.
Yeah, there really is. We don't do sweeps. We do encampment closures, and we've been doing those for 10 years now. And it used to be that, you know, it was put people on a bus, ship them out of town because there was a big event coming, give them a hotel for 2 weeks and nothing else, right? So that wasn't a very effective response. You know, what we do now is a huge coordination between, you know, sanitation, you know, oftentimes Texas Department of Transportation, because they own the land, plans for maybe fencing off or restricting access, outreach workers, housing navigators, and then, you know, all of the HOT folks are out there, the mental health teams, the mayor's office, you know, their main person on homeless initiatives, and everyone working together to go out there and let people know what's going to be happening, when it's going to happen, and what their options are, and trying to really house entire encampments at one time instead of just sweeping people onto the next place.
For today, we're about out of time. Ava, thank you so much for speaking with me and for your commitment to assisting the unhoused population in Houston.